We're going to be doing a 12-week course here on apologetics, on defending the faith. 12 points to show that Christianity are true. I want to go through the 12 points first. This will be the whole course. I'm just going to lightly touch on each point, and then you'll see where the whole thing is going. And then tonight we'll do point one, next week point two, and so forth through the 12 weeks. Point one, truth about reality is knowable. Truth is under attack today. People no longer believe in objective or absolute truth. So the first thing we're going to do tonight is to defend truth, to say there is truth and it can be known. The second thing we're going to do next week, the opposite of true is false. You say, well, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? Well, you're not thoroughly aware of what's going on in the 20th century because we have a lot of philosophies that are denying that. Zen Buddhism, for example. If you've ever talked to a Buddhist, and there are more and more of them. We just got back from Hawaii, and I can't tell you the Buddhist temples I saw all over the islands. They don't believe this, and a lot of philosophers don't believe this, and some of our students are being taught this in schools. Third, and probably the most important point, at least of the first points, is it is true that a theistic God exists. Now, a theistic God is just another term for the God of the Bible, the God of Genesis 1:1, the God beyond the world who made the world, who is personal, moral, intelligent being who created the universe. And then after we discuss that and give arguments to show that it's true, we're going to say if God exists, then miracles are possible. The main objection to the Bible of the modern mind is it's a book filled with miracles. Did you ever see a virgin birth? Did you ever see anyone walk on water? Did you ever see anyone turn water to wine or resurrect the dead? Well, see, how can you believe that if it doesn't happen today, how did it happen back then? And we're going to say if God exists, then miracles are possible. Why? Because if God created the world out of nothing, then the greatest miracles already occurred. So every other miracle is simple. So if point three is true, the first verse of the Bible is true, then the rest of the Bible is believable because there's no miracle harder to believe than God made something out of nothing. So this is a very important point and a very important conclusion. Then we're going to show that miracles can be used to confirm a message from God. If there is a God out there, he's personal, intelligent, and moral. He made us, and we're personal, intelligent, and moral beings. He wants to communicate with us. How would he know, how would we know that it's God talking to us and not an illusion, a hallucination, some demonic power? Well, we would know because only God can do miracles. And miracles would confirm the message that the prophet is given, just like Moses said, Lord, they won't believe me. Moses said, God said to him, well, stick your hand in your bosom, pull it out. It was leprous. Stick it back in. It was cured. What's in your hand? A rod. Put it in the ground. Became a snake. Picked it up. Became a rod. Hit the water. Divided the water. And God said, any more questions? You know, in other words, if they don't believe the message, then they'll believe the message because of the miracles. And then we're going to take a look at something that's under attack in our society all the time. Da Vinci Code, the Gospel of Judas, and the Tomb of Jesus. Every year they come up with some new so-called discovery that disproves the New Testament. The Jesus Seminar that says you can't trust 98% of the Gospels. Our culture is filled with attacks upon the historical reliability of the Bible. So the second most important point, point three, being the first one, is the New Testament is historically reliable. And at that point, we're going to show that there's more evidence for the reliability of the New Testament than any book from the ancient world. We have more documents, earlier documents, better copied documents by more witnesses, more confirmed witnesses than any other book from antiquity. So if you can't believe the New Testament, you have to wipe out all of history. All of ancient history is not believable because it has much less evidence than we have for the New Testament. Then we take a look at the New Testament in the seventh point, and we ask, what does the New Testament say? Who's the central character? And who did he claim to be? Clearly, it's Jesus. You get a red-letter edition of the Bible and just read the red letters in the Gospels. And clearly, he claimed to be the Son of God. Now, if there is a God and miracles can confirm a message from God and the New Testament is historically reliable, we're not talking about without error or inspired or anything, just historically reliable, and they say Jesus claimed to be God and Jesus proved to be God by three sets of miracles, unprecedented and unparalleled. He fulfilled prophecies made hundreds of years in advance, almost 100 predictions. He lived a sinless and miraculous life. Buddha wasn't sinless. He deserted his family. His picture would be on the back of trucks today, a deadbeat father, because he deserted his family, never came back. Muhammad prayed for forgiveness in the Quran, so he wasn't sinless. Jesus is the only one to live a sinless, miraculous life from the moment of his conception through his ascension. It was one endless series of miracles to confirm who he was. Finally, he predicted and accomplished his resurrection from the dead. Now, it's one thing to say, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, be crucified 3 days later, rise from the dead, and another thing to pull it off. Again, we have more evidence, more documents, more witnesses, over 500 witnesses, nine people writing 27 documents confirming that that is the truth. Therefore, point nine, week nine, Jesus is God. Now, at that point, you know, we're rounding third base, headed for home plate, because it's all over but the shouting here. If God exists and miracles are possible and the New Testament is reliable, and then Jesus claimed to be God and proved to be God, then Jesus is God, as confirmed by miracles. And whatever Jesus, who is God, teaches is true, because God can't make an error. God can't say something that's false. And point 11, week 11, Jesus taught that the Bible is the Word of God. Now, he's referring primarily to the Old Testament because the New Testament wasn't written. So he confirmed the Old, promised the New Testament. And the New Testament gives us the words of Jesus' apostles. And he said he would guide unto all truth. Therefore, it is true that the Bible is the Word of God and everything opposed to it is false. Why? Because 2.2, the opposite of true is false. And if it's true that the Bible is the Word of God, that anything anywhere in the world that's opposed to anything in the Bible is false, because the Bible is true. Now, that doesn't mean everything is false. Now, there's truth in all religions. Confucius said, don't do unto others as you would not have others do to you. It just means that anything that's opposed to what's in the Bible can't be true, because the Bible is shown to be true. Now, that's a whole course, so you can go home now and watch TV for the next 11 weeks. No, that's the outline of the course. They say that every good lecture has three things. The teacher tells you what he's going to tell you, then he tells you, and then he tells you what he told you. So I just did point one. I told you what I'm going to tell you. Now we start on point two. I'm going to tell you. And I'm going to tell you that truth about reality is knowable. The people who say there is no truth and it can't be known are not basing their belief on anything that's solid. In fact, I want to cover the following points. First of all, what is truth? Secondly, can truth be known? Third, is truth absolute? Now, if there's anything our culture has taught us, you know, way over, even in the church, way over 80% of people don't believe in absolute truth. That's because we're influenced more by worldly philosophy than we are from our own Christian culture. In fact, according to Barna's survey, 92% of Christians in evangelical Bible-believing churches don't have a Christian worldview, one of the pillars of which is there's absolute truth. 92% of us. That's sad. That's in the good churches. That's not the liberal churches. And that's not, you know, the mosque and the Jewish synagogue. This is the evangelical church. So we're going to show truth is absolute. And then we're going to answer a number of objections that have been raised against us. The Bible says, let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. So we're going to take every challenge we can think of these 12 weeks on every one of these points, and we're going to answer every objection that we can think of, and then any more that you can think of in the question and answer period. Number one, what is truth? Pilate asked the right question. He had the answer standing in front of him, so it's kind of ironic. Jesus said, I am the truth. But we're not going to be cynical like Pilate. We're going to be serious and say, what is truth? You can't know that the Bible is true unless you know what truth is. And you can't know that it's true that God exists unless you know what truth is. So what is truth? Well, in everyday language, truth is telling it like it is. If I say I have a brown Bible in my right hand, the statement is true because it's telling it like it is. I do have a brown Bible in my right hand. Truth is what corresponds to the facts. If I say I have my Verizon cell phone in my right hand, that statement is true because, in fact, I do have my Verizon cell phone in my right hand. Truth corresponds to the facts. Truth matches its object. If I say that this is a metal tray here that I'm speaking from and my computer is on, it's a true statement because it matches its object. There is a metal tray here. So there's nothing tricky about truth. Truth is just telling it like it is. It's a statement that matches its object. This object is a table. Is a true statement because there's a table there that is the object to which the sentence refers. So a statement that matches its object is a true statement. Now, if that's what truth is, what is false? Well, false is what does not tell it like it is. If I say this is a green Bible in my left hand, it's false on two accounts. It's not green, and it's in my right hand. That's not telling it like it is. If I say this is a Coca-Cola in my right hand, it's not true because it doesn't correspond to the facts. It's a bottle of water. It does not match its object. It just doesn't fit. It's the opposite of true. True is what corresponds to reality, and a false statement is what does not correspond to reality. Now, given that, we need to give you the truth about truth. And here is the truth about truth. First of all, truth is what corresponds to reality. That's it. Truth is what actually represents accurately the reality to which the statement refers. Now you say, well, that's just one view of truth. It's called the correspondence view of truth. Well, then how do we know that view of truth is true? Well, that's a good question. I want to answer it. The correspondence view of truth cannot be denied without using it. Anyone who says something that can't be true because it refutes itself is making a false statement. For instance, if I say to you, I don't exist. You say, well, you're there. You exist. And how can you say you don't exist if you exist? In other words, it defeats itself. The correspondence view of truth cannot be denied without using it. Since those who deny it assume that their view corresponds to reality. If someone says to you, well, I don't accept your view of truth. I don't think truth is what corresponds to reality. You just ask him, does that statement correspond to reality? Do you think your view is correct? Do you think your view is based on the facts? Well, if you do, then you believe in the correspondence view of truth. So the very person who attempts to deny this view of truth uses this view of truth in his very denial. Or to put it another way, in reality, everyone holds to a correspondence view of truth. Everyone believes in a correspondence view of truth because if someone asks you to bring him a can of beans out of the pantry and you bring him a plastic bag of corn, he would say, that's not right. Why? Because it doesn't correspond to the reality. Everyone in everyday life uses the correspondence view of reality. Those who deny it in theory use it in practice. I've never seen any philosopher anywhere who tries to defend any other view of truth that doesn't use the correspondence view of truth to deny his other, to affirm his other view of truth. Those who deny it in theory use it in practice. Let me put it in cartoon form so we can picture it. If someone says, I cannot speak a word in English, you would reply, isn't that statement in English? In other words, he can't deny he can speak in English without speaking it in English. If he speaks in English to say, I cannot speak in English, then he's denying what he's affirming. Or what if he says, well, I don't believe the truth is telling it like it is. Then you ask him, is that claiming to tell it like it is? I mean, if you're claiming to tell it like it is, that truth is not telling it like it is, then truth really is telling it like it is, because that's the way you're telling it. You cannot deny it without affirming it. Let me give you some arguments, some reasons here why we accept the correspondence view of truth. Some of them are biblical and some common sense. The correspondence view of truth is implied in the ninth commandment. You shall not bear false witness. That is, don't knowingly misrepresent the facts. What does that mean? That means that God, when he wrote the Ten Commandments, believed in the correspondence view of truth. And if you tell something knowingly that doesn't correspond to the facts, you're bearing false witness. You can't even obey the commandments of the Bible without believing in the correspondence view of truth. It's entailed in Acts 24 when it says, quote, learn the truth when you verify the facts, verses 8 and 11. If you don't believe me, then you can prove what is true by going and checking the facts for yourself. Or it's manifest in Genesis 42:16 when Joseph said that they should look at the facts, quote, so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. Talking about his brothers, you remember, who were saying they had a brother at home. So that your words may be tested to see if you're telling the truth. If you really do have a brother at home, then you're telling us the truth. If you don't, then you're lying. 4. It was employed in the test for a false prophet. In the Old Testament, it told them how they could tell if somebody was giving a false prophecy. If his prophecy was considered false, it was false because if the word does not come to pass or come true. If someone says, tomorrow we're going to have a big earthquake and one-third of the United States is going to be a disaster area, and he said, I'm a prophet sent by God, and tomorrow we don't have the earthquake, then we know he's not a true prophet. And in the Old Testament, they stoned him, if he wasn't stoned already, because he was giving something that didn't come to pass. It wasn't true. Correspondence view of truth. 5. It is utilized in everyday conversation when we consider something false if it misrepresents the facts. For example, what do we say to somebody that doesn't believe us? Well, go check out the facts for yourself. Check it out. Check the facts. That means if what I'm saying corresponds to the facts, I'm telling you the truth. We use it every day in every way. It's essential to a legal oath. If you've ever been in a court of law, you know that you had to raise your hand and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. What does that mean? That means you better tell it like it is. If you don't tell it like it is, you're perjuring yourself and you can be sitting in the clink. So it's essential to everyday life. It's essential to a court of law. It's implied in the Ten Commandments. The correspondence view of truth is the true view of truth. And anyone who denies it is going contrary to his own denial because he's saying my view corresponds to reality. He's going contrary to the Ten Commandments, contrary to the Bible, contrary to everyday communications, contrary to an oath in a court of law. There is the case for the correspondence view of truth. Now, there's some objections to this view, and I want to handle a couple objections. Here's one. Jesus said, I am the truth. He didn't say, I correspond to the facts. Now, how can a correspondence view of truth be the correct one when Jesus himself said something that's contrary to the correspondence view? Good question. Let me respond to it. Jesus' lips and life perfectly correspond to the facts. Jesus never opened his mouth and said anything that didn't correspond with the facts. Jesus never lived anything contrary to the facts or the moral law for that matter. So Jesus does perfectly correspond to the facts in lip and life. So Jesus did use the correspondence view of truth. And when he said, I am the truth, he meant I speak the truth, I live the truth, my lips and life correspond to what God intended for us. Objection 2. Bible says God is truth, and he doesn't correspond to any reality beyond himself. Now, if correspondence means there has to be some object outside of the statement to which the statement corresponds, then what's the object outside of God to which he responds or corresponds? Another good question. Response. God's words and actions do correspond to his nature. God never does anything contrary to his nature. Hebrews 6:18 says it's impossible for God to lie. He couldn't get one out of his mouth if he tried. It got stuck right in his throat, so to speak, figuratively. God's words and actions do correspond to his nature. God is true to himself. One of my favorite verses over the last 10 years is 2 Timothy 2:13. It has a lot of applications, but here's one. If we are faithless, he remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. God is true to himself. And if we are faithless, he's not going to be faithless just because we are. And that being true to himself is perfect correspondence. God perfectly corresponds with his own nature in his actions, in his words, in his intentions. And in that sense, God is truth. Now, what is truth is what corresponds to the facts. What is falsehood? What does not correspond to the facts. Second point, can truth be known? Now that we know what truth is, we can ask the question, can you know it? Is it knowable, or are the agnostics and skeptics right? So I want to answer some opponents of the truth. Relativism, which denies absolute truth, that's very common in our society, as I said. Agnosticism comes from two words. A means no, like atheist means no belief in theism or God. Agnostic is someone who doesn't know. He denies knowing any truth. Skepticism, somebody who doubts all truth. Postmodernism affirms no truth at all. They just sit around and read poetry to each other. Getting mittances of truth trying to poetically protest against absolute truth. So there are four views. Let's take them one by one. Agnosticism. If you're in college or have been in college, you have been taught some of this man's philosophy, whether you know his name or not. Immanuel Kant was the greatest agnostic of all time. He died in the early 1800s. He was a Prussian philosopher. He wrote a book 700 pages long on a critique of pure reason. And he said, you cannot know ultimate reality. Kant said, we just can't know. There's no way you can know the truth about reality. We can only know what appears to us, not what really is. We can know the thing to me, but we can't know the thing in itself. We can't know the thing in itself because there's no way for us to get inside of itself. We only know the way it appears to us. So we must remain agnostic about reality. This form of agnosticism has come down into the modern world, and it was widely accepted in our culture, especially in our intellectual culture in the universities. Agnosticism. How do we refute it? How do we show that we can know? Well, let's go back to our professor here. No one knows the truth. Then how do you know that's true? You see, if you don't know the truth, he couldn't know it's true that you can't know the truth, because that's a truth he claims to know. In other words, he cuts his own throat or hangs himself on his own gallows. Agnosticism fails because it is a self-defeating statement by claiming to know the truth about reality that we cannot know any truth about reality. They're saying, I know that you can't know. Well, now, how do you know we can't know if you know we can't know? Skepticism. David Hume died in 1776, a day to remember. Our country was born that day. He said, doubt all truth. He said, if you come across any statements where people are talking about ultimate reality in the last line in his book, An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, he said, just throw them in the flames, throw them in the fire. They're meaningless. We should doubt everything about reality. We can only know what appears to us, our sense data. We should suspend judgment about all truth claims and reality. Just don't come to conclusions. You got the pro and the con, both sides of it, and you can argue forever. Just be skeptical. How do we respond to that? Because that would destroy everything we believe as Christians. Because we believe that you can know that God exists, that the Bible is the Word of God, that Christ is the Son of God. So how would we respond? Well, skepticism fails because either it's self-defeating by claiming we should be skeptical about everything, including skepticism. That would slit his own throat, or the boomerang hit itself in the back of the head. Or it begs a question by claiming that doubt is the only thing that should not be doubted. So either we should doubt everything, including doubt, which case, if you doubt doubt, you're back to knowing something for sure. Or you should doubt everything except doubt, in which case you're begging a question. Why should I doubt everything but doubt? Tell me why you can make that exception. Response to skepticism, it fails because it is self-defeating, or it begs the question. In fact, there was a philosopher named René Descartes. He died in 1650. He's credited with being the father of modern philosophy. And he had a way of showing that doubt leads to certainty. He said, I doubt, therefore I'm thinking. If I'm thinking, I must be existing. So I think, therefore I am. Now, he was wrong. You have to exist before you can think. He got Descartes before Dehorse. But nonetheless, he had a very valid point here. And here is his point. He argued that the more I doubt, the more sure I am I'm doubting. So just doubt your head off. You know, doubt all you want. Doubt everything that comes to your mind. Doubt until you can't doubt anymore. And you know what? The more you doubt, the more you're sure that you're doubting. And the more you're sure that you're doubting, the more you're sure you exist. Otherwise, you couldn't be doubting. So doubt leads to certainty. It leads to the certainty that you must exist and you must be thinking. And so you have two fundamental facts. I exist and I'm a thinking being that you can't escape. St. Augustine did basically the same thing back in 400 A.D. Only Descartes did it methodologically to show that this is a method by which you can come to certainty. And Augustine, St. Augustine, did it actually. He actually was a skeptic, and he wrote a book coming to the same conclusion against the academics. Hence, doubt leads to certainty. The more you doubt, the more you're sure that you're doubting, and the more you're sure that you're doubting, the more you're sure that you exist. René Descartes. Well, what if someone says to you, well, truth is not telling it like it is? You just ask them, isn't that claiming to tell it like it is? You can't deny truth. You can't deny what truth is. Because every time you try and deny it, it rears its head. Every time you try and push it down here, it crops out there. There's another view called postmodernism. That's the view that kids are being taught in schools today. Here's one of the founders of it, Jacques Derrida, and another guy named Foucault, two French philosophers. And They say we must deconstruct all truth claims. Anytime somebody makes a claim, just deconstruct it and make it mean what you want it to mean to you. And we can reconstruct as many views as possible. So when you get a piece of literature, whether it's the Bible or anything else, just deconstruct it. And once the author says it, it's out of his hands, then the reader is in control of it. Then you reconstruct it as many ways as you want it to mean. On a practical level, it's like a group of people having a Bible study, sitting around in a circle saying, now, would you read that verse? What do you think it means, you know? Or how do you feel about that? That's just pooling ignorance. That's not studying objective truth. There is no reconstruction that is objectively true. There are merely new interpretations. As applied to the Bible, that would mean the Bible means as many things as you want it to mean. And as many people there are, and as many times as they read it, as many new things that it means, but there is no objectively true meaning there whatsoever. You can see what that would do to our Christian beliefs as well. Now, how do we respond to postmodernism? Well, postmodernism fails because either it claims to be true and is thereby self-defeating, which most of them claim they're not making any truth claims. So either it claims to be true. If you say, is postmodernism true? And he said, yes, then it's self-defeating because he's making a truth claim, an objective truth claim, that you can't make objective truth claims. Or else he makes no truth claim and he's not even in the ball game. He's not even in the ballpark. You know, we're talking about truth. We're talking about the ballpark of truth. What is truth that corresponds to reality? Are there any truths? So if he doesn't want to come to the ballpark, if he doesn't want to play the ball game, that's another thing. Then he can't make any statements about truth. But you know, when you read their books, you get all of the impression in the world that they really believe that's true. And they really want you to believe it. Why are they trying to convert our young people? We send our young people there to believe in objective truth, and they're trying to deconvert them. Why? Because they believe their view is true. And they believe that our view is wrong. And they want to give these young people the truth, contrary to what they've been indoctrinated in their churches. So either it's making a truth claim and is self-defeating, or it makes no truth claim and it's not even the ball game. But ignoring the truth doesn't make it go away. There's a truth express. And I don't think ignoring it, sticking your proverbial ostrich head in the sand and saying, I'm not interested in truth, is going to make the truth go away. There used to be a program on radio, many of you will remember, Truth or Consequences. Remember that? Well, if you don't believe in truth, you're going to pay the consequences because there is truth. There are two words that characterize our culture today. Whatever. So what? It's really three words, but two phrases. Whatever. So what? Let me take the so what. We were teaching this for years in seminars, and finally about, seven, 8 years ago, somebody came up with a question that we'd never been asked before. After we went through all of this stuff about truth, they said, so what? And of course, it makes you think, so what? And the answer to that is very important because if you see a sign, if you come to a railroad crossing and the light is flashing and the gate is down and you say, so what? You're probably not going to be long for the world, right? If you're skating on ice and it says thin ice, don't skate, you're probably going to get wet and cold pretty fast. In other words, if you ignore the truth, you're going to pay the consequences. What is truth? It's what corresponds to the facts. Can truth be known? Yes, you can't deny it without affirming it. Third, is truth absolute? Now, it's strange to me that almost the 92% of us in our churches don't believe this anymore, when it's so easy to show that all truth is absolute that when I get through doing it in a few minutes, you're going to say, I don't understand why people don't believe this. Here's one of the modern relativists. Alfred North Whitehead died in the early 20th century. He was the son of an Anglican minister, taught at Harvard University. Don't send your kids to Harvard. The law school there is Marxist. I mean, they're more communist in Harvard Law School than there are in Russia. Really, it's totally filled with Marxism. Alfred North Whitehead, son of an Anglican minister, is the father of modern relativism. He said, reality has no unchanging forms. Everything is in a constant state of flux. No man steps into the same river twice, Heraclitus said. He said, all truth is in process and it's never final. There is nothing you can say, ah, that's absolutely true. Everything is just moving on. All truth is changing and relative. It's like Einstein's theory of relativity. Everything is relative to something that's relative to something that's relative. And, of course, he gave rise to this view of process theology in the modern world, and we must analyze it very carefully as Christians, because if we don't have an answer for the reason of the hope that's in us. Why does relativism fail? Well, it either affirms that relativism is absolutely true, which is self-defeating, because if he says, I'm absolutely sure there are no absolutes, then there are some absolutes he's absolutely sure of, right? There's a great book that was written just about 1985, mid-80s, by a non-Christian Jewish professor at the University of Chicago, very liberal school, and he wrote a book that was a blockbuster. It's called The Closing of the American Mind by Alan Bloom. Alan Bloom was a translator of Plato and Rousseau, impeccable credentials, and he came to the conclusion that what's wrong with our modern universities is we gave up the belief in absolute truth, absolute values, and the Bible as a revelation. Now, that came as a revelation to the academic community, because this was not Jerry Falwell, Tim LaHaye, who had discovered this. This is a Jewish, non-Christian Jewish classicist, classics professor at the University of Chicago. And in his book, he defends absolute truth. And he says, tongue-in-cheek, the one thing you can be absolutely sure of, that every freshman that comes to the University of Chicago is going to be a relativist. The one thing you can be absolutely sure of. Get the point. And so he would ask his students a question. He would say, if you were in India, and you were part of the British protectorate there, and you were given rule over a province where they were still cremating the wives when their husbands died, and that is a practice in remote areas of India, and was even more so before the British came, would you put an end to the practice? So they're cremating women, in other words, you kill the wife and cremate her just because the husband died. What can she do if she has no husband? May as well kill her too. Would you put an end to the practice? Now, there's a little thing down inside of all of us that Jay Budziszewski calls a baloney meter. We all got a baloney meter down there. And whenever there's something like that, the baloney meter goes, nah, you know, don't kill her just because her husband died. But your culture says what? Don't cram your values down them. Don't come over there from your Anglo-Saxon countries and cram your values down the Hindus. So you got a clash, right? If it's all relative, you should let them continue. The baloney meter says, nah, don't let it continue. It's called conscience. It's called Romans 2, 12 to 15, the moral law written in our hearts. And so he'd ask his class that question, dead silence. No answer. So he asked again, dead silence. So he asked a third time. Finally, one student raised his hand and said, the British shouldn't have been there. That's not the question. The question is it right or wrong to kill and cremate a wife because her husband died? And we all know intuitively that it's wrong. But they couldn't admit it. Why? Because they were relativists. Their minds were indoctrinated to say it's all relative. Their heart prescribed by God said it's wrong. It claims its view is just another relative statement and hence is unsuccessful. Suppose they take the other alternative. They say, I'm not saying it's absolutely true. The relativism is absolutely true. Then relativism must only be relatively true. Right? It's either absolutely true or relatively true. If it's absolutely true, you just contradicted yourself. If it's relatively true, then you never established your view because that's just your opinion as opposed to somebody else's opinion. And my opinion is absolutism and yours is relativism. So either their view is unsuccessful or it's self-defeating. Probably simplest way in your everyday conversation with people who say, there is no absolute truth, is just to say, is that absolutely true? Sometimes it just freezes them in their tracks because nobody has ever asked them the question before. There's no absolute truth. Is that absolutely true? And it makes them think. Or it's true for you, but not for me. Now, if you haven't heard this, your proverbial ostrich head is in the sand because this is as common as apple pie. In America today. It's true for you, but not for me. Well, just say this. Is that true just for you, but not for me? I mean, they're making that statement, right? Either that statement is true for everyone, that relativism, or it's not true for everyone. If it's true for everyone, then it's an absolute statement. If it's not true for everyone, then just reject it. That's just true for you. Not for me. But they really believe it's true for everyone, don't they? They really believe their relativism is something that everybody ought to believe in. We call it multiculturalism. That's just a dignified term for relativism and pluralism. But if it's true for everyone, it's not relative. And they believe their view is true for everyone. We assume objectivity and knowability of truth in every area of life. Now, this is just a practical illustration here that everybody believes in absolute truth. When it comes to safety, would you settle for relative truth if if the seatbelt broke and one of your children, your child was killed and a lawsuit came and the manufacturer of the car said, well, we thought it was safe. Would you accept that? Or would you want to know the objective absolute truth? Was it safe or was it not? Where did it break? Did it come apart where you didn't put it together all the way? Or did it actually rip somewhere in the middle? You'd want to know the objective truth. And if you went to the bank and you thought you had $4,000 there and they said you got $40,000, would you say, well, it's true for her? No, you would want to know the objective, absolute truth. When it comes to money, nobody settles for relativism. When it comes to medicine, nobody settles for relativism. I was misfortunate enough to have a kidney stone several years ago, and I had lithotripsy, and the lithotripsy poisoned my body. One or two people out of 1,000 get this, and they die of sepsis. And I was speaking at Junaleska, west of Asheville, and I just went back to my room and just knocked out for 3 hours. And I woke up in the ER room. There are two things you don't want to hear in the ER room. Oops, and oh no. And I woke up in the ER room, and I vomited up blood, and the doctor said, oh no. He knew what I had. Said to my wife, I don't think he's going to make it. Not a good state to be in. But they gave me some medicine, some high-potent medicine, and the two of them kicked in. And I'm lying there, and one night, and the blood letters came in. You know, no offense if you're a doctor or nurse, but, the little vampire bats that let the blood out of you. And I had one on each side. I mean, he woke me up 2 a.m, and one said to me, what's your name? I said, you tell me. I know my name. I want to make sure you know my name. They had a pink band on my right hand that said Gillespie and a pink band on my left hand that said Geisler. I said, this is me right here. And I want to know, did Gillespie get my medicine? Is he alive? Am I getting his medicine? Am I dying? When it comes to medicine, if Gillespie had died or I had died, there'd been a lawsuit, right? And what would they want to know? Not, I thought we were giving them the right medicine. Well, my goodness, it said Gillespie on his right hand, you know. You'd want to know the objective and absolute truth and nothing less than that. She's cheating on me. Well, she doesn't think she is. Or he's cheating on me. Well, he doesn't think he is. Well, who cares? I want to know the objective truth. Is he or is he not? Is she or is she not? When it comes to relationships, we don't settle for anything but absolute truth. William James was a pragmatist. Most Americans are pragmatists. Pragmatism just says, if it works, it's true. If it works, it's good. If it works, do it. And somebody asked him once, a professor at Harvard where he's teaching, named Josias Royce, said to him, would you get on a witness stand? Now, this was his view of truth. Would you get on a witness stand and swear to tell the relative and nothing but the relative, so help me, future experience? No. You get on a witness stand, you're going to have to swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. In other words, objective, absolute truth. Court proceedings are based on it. So everyone really believes in absolute truth. And they don't settle for anything else, whether it's safety, money, medicine, relationships, or court proceedings. They don't settle for anything else than the absolute truth. What is truth? It's what corresponds to reality. Can truth be known? You can't deny it without affirming it. Is truth absolute? You can't deny it without affirming it. Answering some objections. Objection number one. Well, truth changes. What's true today may be false tomorrow. Proof, progress of science. Science keeps coming up with new truths. Science is proof the truth is constantly changing. Is it? Well, there was the earlier truth that the earth was flat and the later truth that the earth is round. Isn't truth changing? No, because truth doesn't change. The earth was always round. The earth wasn't once flat and then became round. It was always round, and when the people believed the earth was flat, they were wrong. They weren't in truth. That wasn't truth one, and now we got truth two. That's error one, and now we have truth one. Those who believed it was flat were in error, not in truth. So truth doesn't change. Objection two. Belief in absolute truth is a narrow view. Now, we usually shrink back when people say, because nobody wants to be called narrow-minded, and this is where the relativistic world has us as Christians on the defensive, and so we have to learn to take the offensive. By the way, I can hardly sit in my chair watching the nonsense that's going on TV today. I debated atheists for 25 years in the universities, and I believe me, they wouldn't get by with what they're getting by with if they said that to me. The first thing I would say if someone asked me about a daughter that got pregnant is, I don't believe in killing them, I believe in keeping them. That's the first thing I would say to anyone. And the very people who are criticizing somebody for whose daughter is having a baby out of wedlock ought to remember that the very people who are making the criticism are the people who are killing the babies, 4,000 every day. 4,000 a day, over 40 million since 1973. Belief in absolute truth is a narrow view. So what do you say? Well, don't back down. Truth, by its very nature, is narrow. That's the way truth is. I'm here and I'm not anywhere else. That's pretty narrow, isn't it? I'm not over there. I'm not over there. I'm not anywhere else in the world. You see, of all the places in the world, how come you picked this one? Well, that's where I am. I'm here. I'm not anywhere else. That's pretty narrow. Here's another narrow one. 4 + 4 = 8. Of all the numbers, the infinite numbers in the world, whether 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11, there's just one answer. Don't you think that's narrow? Yeah, it is. That's the way truth is. It's narrow. These are narrow, but they're true. They're narrow, but they're true. Don't back off from the nature of truth as narrow. All truth is narrow. Even the person who says relativism is true is a narrow view, because he's excluding all other views that aren't relativistic. That's pretty narrow. Absolute truth is narrow. Response. Well, saying atheism is true is narrow, since it excludes all opposing views. See, atheism is true. What does that mean? Anybody who believes in any kind of God or anything else is false. That's pretty narrow, isn't it? Or skepticism is true. Well, that's pretty narrow, because anybody who says he knows anything is excluded. You should be skeptical about everything. You know that pluralism is true is also narrow. All views are true. That's pretty narrow, because it excludes its opposite. If P is true, then all non-P is false. If pluralism is true, all non-pluralisms are false. I just wish once I could be on Larry King Live. A lot of people have tried to get me on, but I'll never get invited. I just wish I could be there once when he pulls this thing about, well, do you think Christianity is the only way? You know, and most people back off, you know. Our big Christian leaders are there, and they say, oh, you know, well, you know, sincere people everywhere might be able to make it. I just wish once I could be there, because I'd say to him, your view is very narrow, because you believe in pluralism and you think anyone who believes anything else is excluded. That's a very narrow view. Your question is built on a very narrow view. All truth claims are narrow and exclusive. Every truth claim is narrow. I don't care whether you say P is true pluralism or E is true exclusivism. They're all narrow because they exclude their opposites. Opposites can't both be true. Objection 3. No one can have an absolute understanding of truth. You're not going to tell me that truth is absolute and you have an infallible understanding of the infallible and an absolute understanding of the absolute. Why, that is arrogance. You've heard it before. How do you respond? Truth can be absolute without our having an absolute understanding of it. You know, my wife and I have been married for 53 years, and I thought I understood love 53 years ago, and I did. I had an understanding of love. But I can guarantee you that my understanding of love has changed in 53 years. I can also guarantee you that love hasn't changed, that love is exactly the same as it was 53 years ago. Just because my understanding of it was an absolute doesn't mean that love is an absolute. And just because my understanding of truth is an absolute doesn't mean truth is an absolute. It's a big difference between the absolute truth and having absolute understanding. There's only one person in the universe who has an absolute understanding of all truth. And it's not me, and it's not you, and it's not the Pope. There's only one person in the universe, and that's God. You have to be absolute to have an absolute understanding of the absolute. You and I just don't have it. We got a hold of a rope. We apprehend, but the rope is so long we can't see either end. We don't totally comprehend. Something can be absolutely true without our having absolute evidence for it. I don't have absolute evidence for very, very many things. I'm absolutely sure I exist, but I'm not absolutely sure about most other things. I have moral certainty, but not absolute certainty of it. But just because I don't have absolute evidence for the truth doesn't mean the truth isn't absolute. It just means my evidence for the absolute is less than absolute. And you would expect that from finite creatures such as we are. Objection 4. There are examples of relative truths. Almost everybody thinks that certain things are relative. Even a lot of Christians who might agree with me up to this point say, well, yeah, there are some things that are absolutely true, would say, but a lot of things aren't. And now I'm going to go all the way and show you that everything is absolutely true. Everything is true is absolutely true. Well, you say, I got some examples to disprove that. Well, give them to me. They're examples of relative truth. I'd say, the alleged examples of relative truth all fail. Because whatever is true for everyone, everywhere, and always. Now, in order for me to establish this point that all truth is absolute, I have to define what a relative truth would be and what an absolute truth. A relative truth is something that's true for some people or some places or at some times, but is not true for all people in all places at all times. Is there anything in the world that's true for all people in all places at all times? That would be an absolute truth. If there's anything that's not true for all people in all places and all times, but just some people or sometimes or some places, then it's a relative truth. Well, let's take the examples and see. I'm going to argue that whatever is true for all people in all places at all times. This man feels cold and this man feels hot are not relative truths. Why? Because both statements are true everywhere. The man on the left feels cold. If you make that statement in Egypt, is that still true? Yeah, because he feels cold. Doesn't matter where you make the statement, outer space, Moscow, Peking, or where. This man feels cold. That statement is true wherever you make it. And it's true to whomever you make it. And it'll be true today and it'll be true tomorrow that that man at that time in that place felt cold. And this man feels hot is absolutely true no matter where you make that statement. That man at that time in that place, because what is truth? Truth is what corresponds to its object. His object is a condition of hotness on the right. His on the left is a condition of coldness. So if truth is what corresponds to its object, it doesn't matter where you make the statement or to whom you make it or when you make it. The one about whom you're making it is absolutely true. There are no such things as relative truths. Well, did the sun once revolve around the earth? No. Truth didn't change. Our view did. So that's not a relative truth. It's absolutely true that the earth goes around the sun, not the reverse. Well, how about this? The statement, it is cold at the North Pole and hot in Egypt. Well, when you make that statement is true everywhere. Now, if I go down on the floor there and make it, it's still true, right? If I go up on the roof and make it, it's still true. It doesn't matter if I have some people up there, different people over here. The statement, it is cold at the North Pole and hot in Egypt, is true everywhere. The truth does not change when it's uttered in a different geographical location. The truth remains exactly the same. Because what is the truth? Truth is what corresponds to the object. The Geisler has a Bible in his right hand. I don't care who makes that statement or where he makes it or when he makes it. That I have a Bible in my right hand is absolutely true for whomever and wherever it is uttered. There are no relative truths. There are serious problems with relativism. Like an old apple, relativism may look good. I've had apples like that too. It may look good on the surface, but it's rotten at the core. It's very appealing. You know, your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth, it's all relative, don't be absolute about anything. But it's rotten at the core. For instance, relativists believe that relativism is true for everyone, and that's a serious problem. Why? Because if relativism is true for everyone, and they got it in our kids' textbooks, and they're teaching it in the schools, and they prove it by the surveys they take, if relativism is true for everyone, then it's an absolutism, not a relativism. But if relativism is true for everyone, then it's no longer a relative truth, but an absolute truth. They're teaching our kids relativism, and yet, they're teaching it as the absolute truth. Someone put it this way. They're standing on the pinnacle of their own absolute, and they're relativizing everything else. Relativism is self-defeating. Another problem with relativism. If it were true, the world would be full of contradictions. If something is true for me but false for you, then opposite conditions exist, since truth is what matches the condition. So if relativism were true, then opposite conditions would have to exist at the same time, like there is milk in the refrigerator and there's no milk in the refrigerator. Can't be. I mean, it's either the statement there is milk in the refrigerator is either true or false. And if there's milk there, it's true. And if there's no milk there, it's false. You can't have opposite conditions, milk there and not there at the same time, in the same sense. That's not possible. Get this. If relativism were true, no one would ever have been wrong about anything. Just think about that. If relativism is true, then anything anyone has ever believed anywhere is true, even if it was false. Now, it's got to be, like it says in the book of Acts, much learning doth make thee mad. You know, it's got to be something wrong with people who can believe that everyone who ever lived has never been wrong about anything. But that's the consequence of relativism. Because if nothing is objectively, absolutely true, then people were going from one relative state to another and no one was ever absolutely wrong. Get this. No one would ever learn anything. Now, I went to college for 20 years. Some of us are slower than others. In fact, I've been in school straight 70 years since kindergarten. Either studying, which I did 20 years formally, or teaching, which I've just finished my 50th year of teaching. If relativism is true, I've never, ever learned anything. Well, was that a waste of time? Was that a waste of time? What's the assumption behind an education? That you get educated. What's the assumption behind that? That you learn some truth where you didn't know before. If we can never be wrong, then we can never learn anything. For learning involves moving from a state of ignorance to a state of knowledge, from a state of not knowing the truth to a state of knowing the truth. There's a little phrase in the New Testament that Paul wrote, ever learning and never coming to a knowledge of the truth. Boy, does that describe our generation. Relative comparisons. Comparisons are alleged to be relative truths. For example, being warmer, better, taller is relative to time, space, and person. I'm tall compared to a pygmy, but I'm short compared to an NBA basketball player. It's all relative. Saying Wilt Chamberlain is taller than Willie Shoemaker is not a relative statement. It will always be true everywhere, at all times, and in all places. The same thing is true of all other comparisons. I don't care where you go and to whom you speak, it will always be true that Wilt Chamberlain is taller than Willie Shoemaker. It's not a relative statement. It's an absolutely true statement. And the same thing is true of all comparisons. You say, X is smarter than Y. I don't care where you say it. If X is smarter than Y, that'll be absolutely true for all people at all times in all places. Conclusion. Beliefs cannot change a fact, no matter how sincerely they are held. I can sincerely believe the world is flat, but it only makes me sincerely wrong. And there are a lot of people who are sincerely wrong. Proverbs 14:12 says, there's a way that seemeth right unto man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Two, truth is transcultural. It's true in every culture. 3 + 3 = 6 is here. It's true here, there, and everywhere. It's true in every language in the world. It's not culturally relative. And yet, if you take a course in cross-cultural communications in a typical seminary in America, they will teach conventionalism, that meaning and truth are relative to the culture. Not true. Truth is absolute. It transcends culture. The laws of math are the same in all culture. The laws of logic are the same in all culture. The truths of God are the same in all cultures. Truth is transcultural. Three, being raised in a given culture doesn't make their beliefs true. For example, being raised a Nazi doesn't make Nazism true. or being raised a racist doesn't make racism true. Just because I was raised in a racist culture doesn't make it so. Truth is not relative to the culture. 4, one's attitude doesn't change the truth. Oftentimes, we as evangelical Christians are criticized for having a bad attitude about the truth. We believe we've got the truth and everybody else is lost, you know. And that gives us a kind of a complex and we back off. But an attitude about truth doesn't change the truth. Suppose you have a bad attitude about 7 times 3 is 21. Suppose your math teacher was obnoxious and you just couldn't stand him, and so... And he always insisted 7 times 3 is 21, so you grew up to say, well, I'm going to think it's 22. I just can't stand what that guy said. Well, does that make it 22 because you had an obnoxious teacher, you had a bad attitude? No. A bad attitude about truth doesn't make it into an error. Suppose you have a liberal teacher. He's just a nice guy. He's just liberal, socialist, Marxist, what have you. Just a jolly, nice guy. You go to college, and this is what happens oftentimes. Because most heretics and most liberals I've ever met were nice guys. They're just wrong. You can be nice but wrong. A good attitude about error doesn't make it true. And a bad attitude about truth doesn't make it an error. Now, I hasten to say that the Bible says, speak the truth in love, and we should have a good attitude about truth and not a bad attitude. I know that. It's not an either or. It's a both and. I'm just saying, just because someone's attitude is bad doesn't change 2 plus 2 into 5. And just because his attitude is good doesn't change 3 plus 3 into 7. 5. Josh McDowell was here, spoke at our church, spoke at the seminary last year, and he spoke, gave the same message the year before. And the message was dead wrong. All 3 times I heard it. Here's what he said. He said, all truth is based in relationships. And I wrote him about it. And I told him that that is not right. Basing truth in loving relationships will enhance the acceptance of a truth, but it will not change the nature of the truth. He was saying, well, if you're reared in a legalistic context, the children aren't likely to accept the truth of Christianity, and they'll react against it. True. Does that mean Christianity isn't true? No. Does that mean truth isn't objective? No. Truth is not based in subjective relationships. That would mean truth was subjective and truth wasn't absolute. Truth is absolute, and it doesn't matter whether you have obnoxious legalistic parents or loving liberal parents. Truth is truth. Basing truth in a loving relationship will enhance the acceptance of it. It's like a sugar-coated pill, you know. You don't want to swallow the medicine, and you put a little sugar coating on it. It'll be easier for them to accept it, but it doesn't change the nature of the pill. If it's arsenic, putting a sugar coating on it will not change it at all. You're still going to die. Basing error in a loving relationship will enhance its acceptance. That happens in cults all the time. I met a girl once who had become a Mooney. I was debating the top Mooney, a guy by the name of Richardson, a Harvard PhD at Northwestern University in Chicago. I was debating him, and after the debate, this Mooney girl came up and said she wanted to become a Christian. And some of the kids who were with me from the seminary led her to Christ. She said, how I got sucked into the cult was... they loved me to death. I'd never been so loved all my life. Came from a home that wasn't loving, got in the cult. They loved her. They hugged her, everything. And she got sugar-coated air. Sure, people be more likely to accept it if it's in a loving relationship, but it doesn't change the truth. Truth is still truth, and air is still air. Loving relations don't change the truth, because basing truth in a loving relationship will only enhance the acceptance of the truth, but won't change the nature of it. Basing error in a loving relationship will enhance its acceptance, but doesn't change it into the truth. Basing truth in a subjective relationship does not change the objective nature, but only its subjective appeal. It'll make it more appealing, but it won't make it from true to false. or it won't make it from relatively true to absolutely true. It's absolutely true or absolutely false, no matter what. Contrary beliefs are possible, but contrary truths are not possible. We're going to talk a little more about this next week in pluralism. You can believe any cockamamie thing you want to believe. You can believe that there's a little pink gremlin pushing his hand around in my watch here. Can you disprove that? No. That's what I believe. A little pink gremlin is doing it. You can believe any cockamamie thing you want, but it doesn't make it true. Contrary beliefs are possible, but contrary truths are not possible. Can't be both true and false at the same time. You can believe everything is true, but everything can't be true. And there are people who believe that almost everything is true. The truth about truth, objective truth, can't be denied. The denial of an objective truth makes a claim to be an objective truth. The very people who want to deny that we have objective and absolute truth are making an objective and absolute truth claim. The claim that there is no objective truth is an objective truth claim. Truth is what corresponds to the facts. Truth can be known. What is true for everyone. It's absolutely true. Okay, we'll stop there and take any questions or comments that you may have about the first and fundamental point. There is truth, and you can know it. If we can't start there and build that foundation, there's nothing, no way we're ever going to get to the conclusion that the Bible is true and it's the Word of God, which is what we get to in point 12. So let me open up for questions. We always skip the first question because nobody ever wants to ask that. And we go to the second question. Feel free to ask questions or make comments. Yes, way back there.
One question I've got for the gospel. It's true, obviously, for anyone around the world. But can he always confront anybody the same way in any culture with the gospel? Or does he have to tailor it somehow?
I think you all heard that clearly. The gospel is true, but do we always confront everybody the same way with the gospel? We always confront them with the same truth, but that doesn't mean that the truth can't be packaged in what's culturally relevant to them. We got to be anchored to the rock and geared to the times, so we can change the expressions, the modes of presenting it, how we do it. May vary, but what we convey has to be the same. Problem with the, for example, emergent church in our culture is they're not anchored to the rock. They're just geared to the times. The problem with some people is they're anchored to the rock, but not geared to the times. So we got, on the one hand, we have the fundamentalists who are anchored to the rock and the times are passing them by. And then we have the liberals, on the other hand, who are geared to the times and aren't anchored to the rock. And we need to do both. We need to preach the unchanging message to our changing times. We need to preach the message of the gospel in the milieu of our culture. So, of course, we become all things to all men that by all means we might mean some in terms of cultural relevance, in terms of music, in terms of, style of dress and culture, as missionaries do, but we cannot change the message. The message is absolute, the message is eternal, and we cannot change it. Good question. Anything else? Yes?
Mike? So there's kind of a mix there when you use the term relevant and relative. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I speak to the question of the difference between relative and relevant. Good question. When I say relevant, I don't mean relative. I mean taking the absolute truth and making it so it appeals to and is understood by the people to whom I'm speaking. I don't mean compromising it and changing it from an absolute truth to a relative truth. I mean without compromising its nature as an absolute truth. I want to say it in ways, Jesus used parables. I want to tell stories. I want to tell illustrations. I want to say it in ways that they will be able to understand it, and it will communicate to them and be relevant to them in the situation in which they live. But relevant and relative are two different things. Any more questions? All right, let's have a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your truth. Your word is truth. Your Son said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Help us never to compromise the truth. Help us to boldly proclaim it. But help us also, Father, to speak the truth in love, to speak the truth in terms of the stories, illustrations, and understanding of our times, so that we can truly be faithful to the unchanging truth of your word and be relevant to the changing times in which we live. And as we go through these steps in showing that Christianity is true, help us to understand each one. And as we build one by one upon them, help us to be able to give a reason for the hope that is in us with meekness and fear, as Peter said in 1 Peter 3:15. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.